Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. This is a very special guest with me. Joe Ide has released his second book about Isaiah Quintabe. It is called Righteous. For those of you who are probably the 1% who didn't read IQ, you missed the story for the century. It is probably the most original and unique suspense mystery thriller I've ever read in my life. And you guys know that I read a lot of books. I want to quote something from IQ, the editorial reviews, that Lou Burney said. He said, "Joe Ide is a bad man. IQ is so hellaciously entertaining, deeply moving, and electrifyingly alive that you'll want to read it twice." Well, I did. Not only did I read IQ twice, I've read Righteous twice. It is my pleasure to welcome back to Authors on the Air, author and award winner, Joe Ide. Hi, Joe. Welcome back.
Thank you, Pam. That's the best introduction I ever had.
Oh, you know, you say that to me all the time, but that's not true. You know, congratulations on the Anthony, the McCavity, the Seamus. You know, you are a fan favorite in Goodreads. The reviews have poured in. You are now a New York Times bestselling author. And all this came because you got tired of writing screenplays. What an amazing thing for you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Pam. Thank you very much.
My
pleasure. I'm in a privileged place.
Yeah, I tell you, and I'm in a privileged place, too, to be able to talk to you. I was reading your NPR interview that you recently did on Righteous, your follow-up to IQ, and it was really funny because the interviewer, who is Karen Bates, said, "If you close your eyes and listen to Joe Ide, you might think you were talking to a black man, a brother who knows his way around the neighborhood. The slang, the infection, it's all there." But for those who have never seen you or spoken to you, they don't know that you are a Japanese American. There's nothing black in you, which is not to say that would be a bad thing, except for the fact that you grew up in the hood, which is how you learn the vernacular, isn't it?
Yes. It was my first language. I had to learn to speak like this.
So I know the story of IQ, and I love the character of Isaiah. I loved his brother Marcus quite a bit. And it just was a riveting look at this young high school dropout, so much so that people continue to talk about that book, and I certainly do. As a matter of fact, I just gifted it to someone who had not had a chance to read it. Now you've got Righteous out. Righteous is even earning more accolades. You've got starred reviews from everyone, and even Michael Connelly has said that you are the best new discovery that he's come along, that has come along for him in a long time. That Isaiah is the kind of sleuth not seen on the mystery landscape before. I totally agree. How are you feeling about all this, Joe?
I'm mostly incredulous. I am.
Tell me why.
I started off with such low expectations. When I finished IQ, the manuscript, I had no idea whether anybody would want to read it. I knew nobody in publishing, and that it not only got published, but people seemed to like it, is really astonishing. I walk around all the time in a state of disbelief. You know, that my second book came out and that people like it, it's extraordinary. It really is.
I know that a lot of your writing about Isaiah in his neighborhood is based on your own experiences growing up.
Yes.
When you decided to... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, please. Ask your question. Sorry, I interrupted.
So, no, not at all. Hey, this is your day, your show. So what I wanted to know is when, you know, you looked around at the neighborhood so you could incorporate your neighborhood into this story, whether it was a fictionalized version or not. But more importantly, you said you can't even describe what your process is for writing IQ. Did you discover your process when you were writing Righteous? Was it more difficult?
Yes, actually.
Was it easier? You did. Tell me about it.
It was difficult. It was difficult at the beginning because I had no process except to sit down and write. And that was really my approach. I don't make outlines. I have maybe a page of beat notes, and then I just start writing. And I write in some detail initially because page one informs page two and two informs three and so on. And if you write every day like I do, you know, you get some momentum after a while. You start to be more competent and write with more ease. And so the process became easier as I went along. As I write, other things occur to me to write about. So it's really pretty organic, but it's disorganized. You know, if I hit a point in the story that I just don't know what happens, I'll just move on to something else. And so by the time I finish the first draft, what I've really got is a skeleton with big chunks missing. And then the rewriting, I just go back and start filling in the blanks. And I may, you know, I'll take, you know, I'll do a dozen passes or so before I have a decent draft, before I have one that's good enough to submit to Little Brown.
Wow. That's a lot of drafts. That's a lot of rewriting. But I think you said something really important that I've heard other authors say. You have to just sit down and write. You have to put words on the paper.
Yes. It's you have to get that momentum. And if you stop to take a weekend off or something, you have to go back and pick up all the threads all over again. And you lose that momentum. You have to remember where you were and, you know, start the engine all over again. So I think it's not uncommon. I think most writers write 7 days a week for the same reason. And they take a vacation when they take a vacation. I don't believe in writer's block. You know, I think writer's block is just getting out of your chair. Stay in your chair. You stay
right
in your chair and write two good sentences, that's two more than you had yesterday.
There you go. That is true. Do you enjoy the process of writing?
Oh, I love it. It's a particular kind of focused high. I'm completely in the book myself. My head is full of what's going to happen next, and it's an outer body kind of thing. I can't think of anything else, and it's just I can't wait to get up in the morning and write and see what's going to happen. And
wow.
when I'm nearing the finish line, like say I have another month to go before I finish, I get into an absolute frenzy. You know, I'm working 10 or 12 hours a day, reworking sentences I've worked over, you know, a dozen times before. And I get obsessed. And it's terrific. It's a terrific place to be. I mean, it's not fun, but it's fun.
Because some authors have said to me that the writing is not fun, but the finishing is great fun. And the result is fun, but it's a very difficult process for them. And I find that fascinating because, I mean, I love what I do. I'm assuming that you made a choice to be a writer, and so you must love what you do. And also, it's interesting to me, you've walked in the street that your character has walked in. You've walked those same roads and sidewalks and been in the same stores. So I would imagine having that background and writing about that background with this fictitious character feels comfortable to you. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. You know, when I was thinking about what to write, I never really considered any other background. I felt comfortable writing in that milieu, and I knew it really well. So there wasn't much I had to imagine. The material was just there. I never thought that my background would be of any use. You know, I wasn't ashamed of it, but I never gave it much thought. And here I am.
I know that for a long time you wrote screenplays. You wrote for Disney and you wrote other screenplays until you were tired of writing screenplays. You just said, you just couldn't write one more. We're going to talk about screenplays again later on. But do you think that having been a screenwriter helped you make your manuscript, your writing real tight so that you weren't just doing background and narrative? You were actually propelling the story forward, because screenwriting is a different animal than writing a whole book, but you do have to get the story out rather quickly. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is. Screenwriting taught me brevity. It taught me precision. And it taught me to write visually.
And, interesting.
It also taught me discipline. So screenwriting really helped me. It helped me. It was limiting. When I started to write IQ, I discovered that my long-form prose was just awful. It was terrible. It was embarrassing.
Sure. Were you used to just writing dialogue, sentences of dialogue, and that's pretty much it?
Yeah. And you know, if there's a nice house in the suburbs, all you do is write exterior, nice house in the suburbs.
Wow.
You know, it didn't challenge you in the way long form prose challenges you. I'm not saying it's lesser, it's just different and more.
Right. So it's my understanding that your books have been optioned and that there's some discussion about turning them into some type of episodic, maybe television or one of the streaming things. Are you looking forward to that? Do you want to see your work on the screen?
Yeah, I'd love to. And the book and the pilot are in development. And I try not to keep track of it because it's a lot of anguish, you know, waiting for somebody to do something and so-and-so
sure.
like the thing.
Right.
And so I focus on writing my books, and I know the TV process, and it takes a long time, and there are a lot of bumps in the road. And so I leave it to the producers, and they're really good. They are really good.
I read that you said, I don't care if it gets made into, you know, if it goes on film, whether it's the small screen or the large screen, as long as you don't have to write the script for it. You were very happy letting somebody else write the screenplay for you. Is that true?
Oh yeah. No, to turn a book into a screenplay, you have to make all these decisions about which characters you're going to keep, what you're going to cut, which parts of the story you're going to keep. And so the closer you get to an actual pilot, to an actual show, the farther away you get from the original material. I didn't want to make those decisions.
Sure.
And also I didn't, you know, the first script is a pilot. I don't know how to write a pilot. So for all those reasons, I was happy to have them do it.
I remember when we spoke the first time, when we talked about IQ, you mentioned that you were a big fan of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and some have suggested that your character and your writing is very similar to Holmes in a kind of modern way, and that your writing style is very similar to Conan Doyle. How do you feel about that?
I feel great about that. You know, Sherlock was identified with Sherlock growing up. I mean, I read all 56 stories like multiple times.
Wow.
And I thought he was like me in the sense that he was an oddball, a misfit, and he wasn't physically intimidating. But, you know, unlike me, he had an identity. You know, he knew who he was. And if he met bad guys, you know, he could overcome them with just his intelligence. And that was really key for me, because it meant that a kid like me could face the world and not be afraid. And so he's always been with me. And both Sherlock and Conan Doyle have a huge influence on me. In fact, the big dog in IQ was a take on the Hound of the Baskerville.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Having read it so long ago, it's hard for me to remember it. But and conversely, kind of like you, I was a fan of Agatha Christie. So, and I read all of her 102 books in order, and very fast. So I understand the need to stay close to that genre. Let's talk about Righteous. In the first story, for those of you who don't know, Isaiah is kind of the neighborhood go-to private investigator, even though he's not really. He's just a really smart kid who's lost his brother. Will you pick up the story and tell us where it starts again in Righteous, please?
Righteous picks up right where IQ ended. There's a scene at the end of IQ where there is this girl, Grace, that he's been intrigued by, but he really lacks social skills, and he's really afraid of going up and saying hi. But he sends his dog, you know, to say hi instead. And in Righteous, the book picks up right there. I finished that scene at the beginning of the book, and the young woman, Grace, becomes his client. She's looking for her mom. She hasn't seen her in 10 years. Her mom disappeared suddenly, mysteriously, and Grace has seen her, got a glimpse of her, and knows she's in the city. So she hires Isaiah to find her mom. Unbeknownst to both of them, the bad guys are also looking for her mom. The bad guys are ex-CIA from Abu Ghraib and participated in the torture. They are vicious guys. They are scary guys. They are looking for Sarah, for Grace's mom, too. Her mom has secrets that could send the bad guys away forever, ruin their lives. And so it's this race between Grace, Isaiah, and the bad guys. Who's going to find her mom first? And that's sort of the basic A story. There's also a subplot with Dodson. He has his own sort of subplot. He's being blackmailed and from someone in his past. And in order to get the blackmail off his back, he has to team up with Duranda, who we met in IQ. And they don't like each other. And they're really an odd couple. But that's Dodson's subplot. And he's had a baby. And
I love that story. It's a great story, by the way. It's such a nice – the dichotomy there is so great to have Dodson, this doting daddy, and, you know, his crazy baby mama and everything. It's a lot of fun to read, by the way. He's a really great sidekick. As a matter of fact, I think Goodreads just did a little contest about sidekicks. Dodson was nominated as one of the best sidekicks. I like the fact that you have these overlapping stories going on. And it's so while Grace is part of Isaiah's life, Isaiah is also trying to figure out about what really happened to his brother, who was killed in a hit and run accident, which he's learning is not really what is happening. So Isaiah has a lot on his plate besides this crush he has on this woman who hires him or young woman who hires him to find her mom. And, you know, there's so many different little stories kind of weaving together. It keeps it so interesting. I think I read Righteous as I did IQ in one sitting. I read it in one day.
Wow.
And that's when I went back to read IQ again, because I thought, okay, I read IQ last year. I need to read Righteous again, you know, read it again, just to remember all the characters. It was so well done. Congratulations on your many successes with this. When we were talking in the green room, you mentioned that you've wrapped book three.
Yes.
So I'm going to assume that Isaiah is going to be your series character for the foreseeable future. Is that true?
Yes. Yes, that's true. I'm going to stay with him as long as people like the books.
I like him because he's a young guy, and he's got lots of growth ahead of him and lots of places for you to take him. Do you think that there will come a point when you'll just say, I think I want to take a break and write a standalone? Do you have any other ideas swirling around?
Yeah, I'm planning on writing a standalone. But I'll do it while I'm writing IQ.
Really?
Yeah, it's not like an either-or proposition.
Fabulous.
Sometimes I just run out of gas for IQ, or I lose my concentration. And writing something else it helps me get my concentration back. And it's sort of an antidote to writing about IQ, you know, 8 hours a day. So I'll write a standalone.
Joe, do you still go back to your neighborhood that you grew up in?
Occasionally. Sometimes I go downtown with my brother to see a Laker game. And we'll take a little diversion and drive through the neighborhood and reminisce about the people there and where our house was and who got shot where and
wow.
The characters in the neighborhood. And you know, it's fun. And yeah, we occasionally do that.
Is that an adrenaline boost for the story when you do that? Does it connect you immediately to your stories?
Visiting there is just fun, but I don't need to connect there. I'm already connected.
You're connected. Yeah.
My roots are there, and it's not hard for me to get back into that place.
Interesting. I don't want to keep you forever because I know you're a very busy man and you love to sit down and write, but I do want to ask you five quick questions and five quick answers. We played Final Five before. You want to try it again?
Sure.
Let's see if I can come up with something different for a change. So whose book are you reading, by the way, right now?
Greg Tennant's, My Absolute Darling. It's a hell of a book.
Oh, good.
It's actually too good.
You want to do nothing but read, right? I know the feeling, Joe. It's what happens when I read an eBay book. I want to do nothing but read.
Thank you.
When you look at IQ and then you look back at Righteous, what differences do you see in your writing style or your process or anything? Or do you see it being a smooth transition from one book to the next?
I hope I'm better with Righteous. You know, I feel better. I feel more at ease. It's just, you know, the product of writing every day for so long. I think I'm more competent. I think I have a little more mastery, and I hope that continues. I want to be better from book to book.
I would imagine. Well, it certainly seems like you are, although there was nothing wrong with IQ. I thought it was a masterpiece. I would imagine now that you've been out and about and you've been on book tour that there are some aspiring writers who want to know what they should do if they think they have a great idea for a book. What do you tell them?
I tell them that it's in many ways all about the quality of the writing, the mastery of the craft. Some people, young writers, think it's about the story or the concept, but that's important. But it's really about the craft. You know, I think you probably know this, but Michael Connelly wasn't successful until his seventh or eighth book, but his editor hung in with him because he was that good. And the people who, the decision makers in terms of books, they've read everything. And so your book is not being judged in a vacuum. It's being judged in the context of all of these great writers. And they want quality. They want quality. I don't think it's enough these days to write a good, solid crime novel, you know, because the publishing companies have under contract writers who can write a good, solid crime novel.
Crime novel,
and it's sort of a harsh question, but it comes down to who needs you. And I think you really have to write a novel that's a cut above. And to get their attention, you have to write that breakout novel.
Yeah, I guess you're right about that, because there are a million books printed every year through Amazon alone, so
right.
Or put up for sale through Amazon. So, yeah, you do. You have to stand out. I have had people say to me, you know, I have a story I want to tell, and what should I do? And I ask them if they're readers, and a lot of times they will say, no, I don't read really that much.
Wow.
Do you think it's possible for someone to be a writer if they're not a reader?
No. No. It's like being a jockey and you don't like horses.
Right. That's a good analogy. That's a great analogy.
you really do have to be a reader. You really do have to be a reader.
Because you don't. How can you understand a story structure or story arcs and things like that? You know, how can you understand tension in a story or how to write dialogue and all? So it doesn't make any sense to me. I guess it's possible, but I just don't know how. So
it's
and of course, yeah, I'm not. You know, listen. Being a reader doesn't make you a writer either, because if that was the case, I'd be writing like it was going out of style, but I can't connect sentences. Listen, I can barely get out of the front door with my dress on the right way, so I could never write a book.
You have other skills.
I read.
You do more than that. You're really good at what you do.
Thank you. I have the best time talking on the show with people like you. My last question to you is, when you look back at your young self, what do you think your young self would think about you now?
My young self would also be incredulous. I didn't see a future like this. I wasn't really big on looking at the future. I was more preoccupied with today and tomorrow, and taking the long view wasn't anything that I indulged in. I didn't think about my future until I was well into my 20s.
Do you recall what you wanted to be when you, quote, grew up?
I had no idea.
Interesting.
I was really a dilettante.
Well, that's okay, too.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about talking. Just as an aside, I want to say, I read a funny quote from you about why you didn't want to be a teacher. Would you care to tell us why you didn't want to be a teacher?
Oh,
I didn't like kids.
I didn't like kids.
They ask you too many questions.
They're loud and they're fussy and a little belated. You know, when I discovered that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, you had no idea ahead of time, right?
Yeah, you think I knew going in.
Joe, you're so funny. You are so funny. Do you have a title for book number 3?
Yeah, it's called Wrecked.
I love it.
As in a car, the car was wrecked. Yeah.
Right. Joe Ide, you're just one of my favorite people and favorite authors. I cannot thank you enough for being with me. Promise you'll come back when Wrecked is published in the fall. And hopefully I'll see you at BoucherCon or Thriller Fest. And thank you for coming again and taking your time to be with me.
It was really my pleasure, Pam. And ask me back anytime.
You know I will. I'm taking you up on that offer. Thank you so much. Joe Ide, you are the best. Thanks for being with me, everybody, and I'll talk to you in the next episode.